Welcome to a podcast on Fire Network bonus episode time, and we're doing three more Korean shorts. In the main episode of What's Korean Cinema, we talked of six short films from Korea. Quite small, quite beloved, in the case of Doggy Poo, and some that were very much seen and some that were very much not seen. But ironically, for the bonus discussion, we picked three shorts from three big directors rather than feature them all in that episode of What's Korean Cinema, which was episode 43. But it's kind of what we do. It's one of our quirks, I suppose. And I'm going to be still with you, if you will, even though that episode was last week, but we're still here. And with me also still is Paul Quinn of Hango Celluloid. So a quick hi before we quickly get into it.
Good evening, everybody.
And it's not like we try to avoid an audience by excluding the big ones from the main coverage, but I don't know, it just happened this way, and I was happy about the selection for the bonus ones.
I mean, from my point of view, the main episode was really because of the movies we chose. You know, that a lot of them, I'm close to them. You know, they mean quite a lot, and it was the choice of those rather than anything else. And it was only in hindsight when you mentioned the bonus episode that I thought, well, we've done a lot of small people, let's do the big ones. And I think it's nice to do it sort of inverted, I guess.
Exactly, and very much. And it gets discussed when all was said and done, and it's what we're doing here in this website exclusive bonus episode. It won't be on iTunes. If you're hearing this, it will only be on podcastonfire.com. And we're going to get into it really quick, starting with our discussion of the short movie Memories from director Kim Ji-woon, director of A Tale of Two Sisters, The Good, Bad, and the Ugly, and the much beloved from guru Paul Quinn, The Last Stand. He said ironically as he read off his outline, but it does
have to be said, just in the build up to this, slightly non-Korean this is, but never mind, in the build up to this, you're checking through the TV for later on for something just to fall asleep in front of the television too, and Total Recall's on with Arnie. Mm-hmm. And you know, mm-hmm, ultimate cult enjoyment, love it to death.
Let me summarize it for you, Total Recall, because I did it on Facebook many years ago, and there's no other way to summarize Total Recall. Starring violence.
Totally, totally.
Because it's fucking Paul Verhoeven, man, like starring violence, that's right.
Just wah. And I only mention it because if you take The Last Stand with, again, Arnie, directed by Kim Ji-hoon, if it was on the TV, I would specifically watch something on another channel.
Well, hopefully he'll if he ever gets another Hollywood adventure, hopefully it will, in your eyes, be a better one. But because I haven't seen The Last Dance, I can't form an opinion. Not yet.
Well, you know, it's just my opinion, but it's... Let's hope he just sticks with Korea.
So let's head into it, as we said, talking of Memories from director Kim Ji-woon, and it was released within the Omnibus Project 3 in 2002, that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. And that feature movie with three shorts also featured The Wheel from Thai director, and I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing this, it's one of the easier Thai names though, oddly enough, Nonsi Nimbutur, which I believe is the director of Jandara, which is a erotic drama, and I believe he did like a ghost movie called Nang Nak. And he's also a prolific producer in the Thai film industry, so he's not a small-time director. And three also featured the short Going Home from Hong Kong from director Peter Chan. And that short was quite critically acclaimed and scored big with awards juries. Taiwan's Golden Horse Awards rightly awarded actor Leon Lai with the Best Actor statue. And it seems like, from this perspective of the Hong Kong film fan, which I'm coming from, that under the direction of Peter Chan, we mostly see that uneven, sometimes even boring actor Leon Lai, and he's also a singer, we see him flourish under the direction of Peter Chan. They also collaborated on movies such as Comrades Almost Love Story, which is a classic romantic drama. And Leon Lai was also cast, and you might have seen this, Paul, in the third Infernal Affairs movie for directors, yes, Andrew Lau and Alan Mack. He was a new cast member for that one, so he wasn't a recurring character through all three. and actress Eugenia Yuan playing the, well, the dead wife in Going Home, also won the Best New Performer Award at the Hong Kong Film Awards, and this is actually the daughter of actress Cheng Pei Pei of Come Drink With Me and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon fame. That was Going Home, so back to Korea's Memories instead. So and that one starts free. It's the first short in free. But plot from IMDb. Memories, made by Kim Ji-woon, is about a woman, played by Kim Hae-soo, who disappears from the home she shares with her husband, played by Jung Bo-seok, and children, and end up in a futuristic city filled with many disturbing hindrances to her finding her way back home. And I don't have any questions as such, but this one popped up. The timeline suggests that Memories came out before A Tale of Two Sisters, Kim Ji-won's classic horror drama, really. Is there any way to know if he shot this right before A Tale of Two Sisters, during, after, but Memories was released first when all was said and done? Because it really seems like the timing is so fortuitous that he's in horror mode and therefore could easily slip into Memories or slip into A Tale of Two Sisters.
From what I can gather, I mean, if you look at the actual release dates, Memories was released May 2002 and Tale of Two Sisters was released June 2003. From what I can gather, Memories was made a few months or finished a few months before it was actually released because it was a short and et cetera, et cetera. And considering the fact that that takes it to sort of 18 months, there's no definitive answer, but I would almost guarantee that it was done and dusted and finished before he actually started into A Tale of Two Sisters. And as you, certainly from my point of view, as I went through it, there are certain camera framings, you know, camera work that sort of echoes what comes in A Tale of Two Sisters, and I'll talk about what I feel about them later, but it sort of said to me that it's almost him using them before he uses them in A Tale of Two Sisters. So I would almost guarantee we're looking at two separate timelines, one finished and then he moves on to his big feature.
And even if it wasn't planned out as a warm-up or anything, it certainly reminded me of the way Tony Scott treated his short Beat the Devil. It was warm up for Man on Fire because he had stylistic ideas that he wanted to try out, and he did it for that short movie / commercial for BMW. And when you watch Beat the Devil, you see all kinds of Man on Fire stylistic traits there. So it was a warm up movie sort of designed like that. He tried out certain cameras and things like that. So let's move into Memories then, and as we did in the first or the main episode, Robert, we'll take turns rather than discuss back and forth, but if I have a question, I'll just interrupt, as I always do, but okay. You're free to do so as well. And as for my short opinion, and then I'll do my notes, it has effective atmosphere. Kim is not afraid to use startles and such scare tactics. That's quite old hat, but the mystery involves to a fair degree, and the two perspectives, because we see the story from the perspective of the wife and from the perspective of the husband. As we see that play out in front of us and the puzzle gets laid down piece by piece, that remains fairly intriguing and even heartbreaking to a decent degree towards the end. So would I call it a classic? No, but I was involved for the 40 minutes and enjoyed the twist towards the end. So you could just jump into that right away, that he's not afraid to use startles and scare tactics of old, but seeing those early images of the creepy dolls and the jarring editing, that's the jump scare as the doll
turns its head.
It's not as cheap as it sounds like, and I don't think any of the things he does feels like laugh out loud sort of, oh my god, here's a filmmaker that's not comfortable in horror. It's more or less, well, I can't think of any way to do it, so I'm going to put forth my best professional sort of visual and oral technique, and he earns that, even though it is literally a little bit of a 5.1 boom. But what I also enjoyed, that if you watch the movie, I'm sure you noticed that a lot of it is static. A lot of it is a camera slowly following things. That must be the most boring filmmaking to do on set, because it's a bunch of slow camera moves that will come to life in post-production. But I don't mind it, but it's one of those, like, It's not like, hey, we're making a movie. Like, put the camera there, put the camera there, put the camera there, party on. No, it's more like, slow, follow, stop, cut, done. That's going to be scary later.
Yeah, totally. I've got a few things to say about that as well, but I'll let you carry on. I agree with you anyway. Yeah.
Right. And the images of any lady with long hair, that could spark some cynicism, but it is the early 2000s. The cliche has not worn out as such. The whole Ringu from Japan, the sort of visual cue there. But I feel he's aware and confident in doing the horror stuff, but adding as much unique atmosphere as he can. And, you know, it depends on mostly visual flashback, but there's some audio flashback and noted. So he fills the movie with that, and we watch in curiosity despite not having the full context. There's abstract fragments here. For instance, like this, it's totally weird that the wife is on a pavement, but she's now alive and now she's getting up because we've realized that she's either missing or dead. That's intriguing enough. And the whole doctor session that happens subsequently with the husband and the doctor, that isn't a lazy exposition dump either, because there is a mysterious feeling here that I think works fairly well. And especially as the husband that Jung Bo-seog plays, he senses surroundings are closing in on him. And there's sounds somewhere, and he sees things and objects. And that works fairly well. It's quite okay. And Kim even gets away with using grainy camcorder footage as flashback, not to flash us into found footage or anything, but mainly as a flashback technique. That, Paul, by the way, is way more, to me anyway, real and non-manufactured versus today's grindhouse. Let's add like specs to the print and crap like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
So it's an interesting device visually, because those flashbacks are set in a parking garage / construction site. So the actual environment is wet and dark, and there's gravel and things like that. So I thought the use of it was quite intriguing. I got this, maybe it's because a friend of mine has been posting about John Carpenter recently. I got this flashback to how John used camcorder footage in Prince of Darkness. To quite a haunting effect, actually. Stuff of nightmares when I was little, the images in that particular film. Yeah. So it's entirely up in the air for a while, memories in terms of what it is and what the story is. But that's good, actually. I wasn't frustrated. He ties it up. He intercuts well enough. It's mapped out well enough. It's visually interesting. Because after a while, we realize that there is two different perspectives going on here. The wife and the husband don't interact. She's on her search, and he's waiting around, and the family is concerned for the wife. And he's almost gleeful in terms of, we know he's probably going to scare us. No, he's probably going to scare us now, because at one point someone is listening to an answering machine, and there's like weird sounds on the answering machine. You almost think like, oh, there's a hand going to come up out of the answering machine or some crap like that. But I don't know. Many directors might get away with this, but I think it comes off as, you know, how else can you do horror? So let's just play with it, and let's have the audiences in our hands, and either scare them or not scare them. Just distract them by maybe a doorbell. You know, even opening drawers and cupboards and things like that. We sit there, no, it's going to be something there. Also, to round off my notes, he's good at nightmarish sights, like he was in Tale of Two Sisters, these otherworldly nightmarish sights that might consume you. You know the iconic scenes in Tale of Two Sisters where they just go, oh, you know, the scene never stops. You just feel like, oh my God, that thing is going to consume that other thing. And in the end, it's kind of is heartbreaking. I don't want to spoil it, obviously, because some imagery from the beginning is reprised from another perspective, and you realize that some of this was about drama and not fright. So there's enough complexity, even though it is a short movie, so it's not classic complexity. And psychologically, it's also about memories to a degree, but still, you take the events as literal too. The plot is spelled out for you visually and in the storytelling, so it's not a deep thematic behind it. But I think it's a good time. And would I rank it like at the top of Kim Ji-woon experiences? you know, not at the top, but it's fine. It's absolutely okay. And this is a filmmaker that enjoys making horror, clearly. So I thought it was okay, very much okay. Let me hand over to you and have you relive memories.
I pretty much agree with you on all counts. I mean, when I went to rewatch this, I did a quick look at his timeline, really, just to see where we were.
Oh my God, The Last Stand still exists. Damn it.
No, not my DVD. I burnt it. He started, obviously, in 1998 with The Quiet Family, which was, if you like comedy horror, comedy was a big part of it. Followed that by The Foul King, which was, again, you know, very humorous, about a down and out guy who decides to become a wrestler. Three, his segment for Three, Memories, was his next thing. So if you like, this was his first look at horror per se, as horror in a serious form. From that point of view, I can let a lot of the things you see, yeah, there are jump scares, there are kind of predictable camera angles where, you know, Kim Hsu's standing in the middle of the street and the camera starts to revolve around her and then stops, etc., etc. I'd almost let them go because I felt that he was legitimately testing the waters. And they mostly work. And they're not particularly innovative, I guess, but they work to a decent degree. And considering the fact that you do see some of them in A Tale of Two Sisters, which is utterly sublime, shows that his work was worthwhile. In terms of the story, I liked it. I enjoyed it. I liked the twist at the end. I liked the two timelines. The only thing I would say is, if you look back at New Korean cinema, as I overly tend to do.
Well, you're a veteran of it. You have it in your memory bank. So it's not hard to craft a map in your mind in terms of who did it better, who forwarded the genre, who did the tropes better and things like that. So.
Totally, totally. But if you look at the way he does things, you've already talked about the really slow, the camera's moving forward, it's zooming in and it stops, etc., etc. It reminded me to a degree of what was really, really prevalent at the time, which was films that were very sedate, very standing.
Still and standing as sort of,
you know.
The Uninvited was quite static, but that was very much to its advantage.
You know, films like that really did that thing well. And I think Kim Ji-eun was trying to trip into that. And I just don't think he managed it as well as he would at a later stage. I mean, some of the slow stuff in A Tale of Two Sisters, just like you say, it just goes on and you've got shivers going up your spine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it works to the same extent in this. I think this was him trying to do it and learning to do it. And it kind of, at times, it feels forced. I could actually, you know, go, oh, the camera is going to move now. And it sort of pulled me out a little bit.
You know what? I noticed it more at the beginning, but not as much as the movie started to play out its plot.
That's not necessarily a criticism, I think. I think this was a work in progress for his things to come. The one thing I'll say about this short and one of the other two that we're going to talk about is that the big plus point for me is looking at the cast, because you've got in both these films actors and actresses that became huge names, synonymous with New Korean cinema at the time. You know, I mean, they were massive. And if you look at the two main actors in this, we've got Kim Hee-soo from 2001, has been acting, you know, in iconic films like Kick the Moon, The Red Shoes, which is based on Hans Christian Andersen's story, and it's a phenomenal horror film. She's gone on to do Chong Dong-hoon's The Thieves, The Face Reader. She's still going today, you know. She's got a film called The Fault coming out later this year. So she's massive still. And she was big back in the day. And you look at Jung Bo-suk, the man who plays the husband, his face is less recognizable. But, you know, he was in Virgin Stripped Bare by Our Bachelors by Hong Sang-soo, which is, you know, one of the most famous Hong Sang-soo films there are going. He was in a fair few really iconic films. And in 2006, he just stopped and moved to TV. And he sort of sadly missed. And it's why nobody really recognizes him if they even look back and see him. But these were iconic people, and we'll talk about the actors and actresses in the other short when we get to it. But that, for me, as it is as big a part of this as anything else, because we've got Kim Ji-eun pushing his new career forward and heading towards being, you know, one of the big names, and he's taking these actors with him. And I think that's something to be very proud of.
Do you remember offhand any feelings you might have had about the other shorts in Free, Thailand's The Wheel, and Hong Kong's Going Home? Or you need to rewatch those to form a new opinion?
I absolutely adored Going Home. It's stuck in my mind. The Wheel, I have virtually no recollection of, I have to be honest.
It is the weakest one, without going into a new review, but it is the weakest one. It feels, you know, it's unique to Thailand, the story, but it still feels sort of standard horror in a way. I wasn't that involved with it. So it's still 30 minutes and then it's over. But I rewatched Going Home, and Peter Chan is a fantastic director, not associated with horror necessarily, but just a professional director. And Comrades, Almost a Love Story, his other iconic film, I suppose. He did Warlords, which was a remake, Jet Li and Andy Lau. But when you watch the whole three, you realize that they weren't tied to the fact that we need to make it all scary.
Yeah.
Because Going Home is, it's the two H words in this one, one of which isn't horror. It's haunting and heartbreaking, because it is heartbreaking. And that's all I'm going to say about it, because I think we're going to dedicate an episode sometime to it in Podcast on Fire. But they hit it out of the park, and out of the three shorts, I think Hong Kong came out strongest, if you needed to compare between the countries, if you will.
I would tend to agree with you there too. And just, you know, in getting all notes together for this, it became blatantly apparent that Going Home has really, out of all the films, been the most readily and accepted and welcomed, because in 2011 and 2012 there were two Peter Chan retrospectives, one in Hong Kong and one in Italy, and both of them had Going Home, you know, as a prominent piece in the retrospective of his works, even though it's just a little short film. And I think that's something to be proud of as well.
Indeed, and I'm glad it is recognized indeed. I mean, Free broke through because there was a follow-up to Free, which leads us into the second short, i.e. there was enough box office there to add budget and to shell out for even bigger directors, not just directors in transition and then one veteran director, because Peter was a veteran director by that point. So if we move over to the second short from Korea, which is Cut, from 2005, that's when Free Extremes was put out, and it's by director Park Chan-wook. And plot from Wikipedia: a successful film director has to face a night of misery when a man who appeared in five of his films as an extra captures both him and his wife to play a deadly game. The director is played by Lee Byung-hun, the kidnapper and extra by actor Im Won-hee, and the mostly tied up and silent wife by she's played by Kan Hae-jung. She has about two or three lines, I suppose, they are key lines, if you will. So Free, as I say, got a follow-up in the form of Free Extremes, and raised the stakes by adding a roster of three even higher profile directors across the board. It featured the short movie Box from Japanese director Takashi Miike, Itch the Killer, They're Alive, the Quiet Family remake, Happiness of the Katakuris, and about, well, over 100 other movies. Like last year, he crossed his 100th movie sort of benchmark. He's been at it, Takashi Miike. Free Extremes also featured Cut from Korea's Park Chan-wook and Dumplings by Hong Kong's Fruit Chan. And he had not really dabbled in horror at all, but rather Hong Kong-centric thematic movies about the 1997 handover, such as Made in Hong Kong and The Longest Summer. And he'd done quite a quirky comedy called Hollywood Hong Kong a year or two before Free Extremes. And his lead, Paul, Miriam Jung, she was also the sort of rom-com queen of Hong Kong. So her role in Dumplings as a woman obsessed with her age and trying out fetus-filled dumplings, yes, in order to halt aging. That was a left turn for the actress. Dumplings was also expanded into a feature edit, which seemed to be the plan originally because it came out shortly after Three Extremes as a whole came out in Hong Kong. So it was extended by an hour, essentially. And across Hong Kong and Taiwan, that movie Dumplings was honored with Best Supporting Actress Awards, going to actress Bai Ling, and also actor Tony Leung Ka-fai got a Best Supporting Actor Award for his work in the feature version of Dumplings. He has three scenes in the 37-minute Dumplings, one of which is a sex scene. No, two of which are sex scenes. So Tony Leung, quite a workhorse. He's Big Tony out of the two Tony Leungs, if you will. So because he also got Tony Leung Chiu Wai from In the Mood for Love and so forth. So as for cut from Park Chan-wook, yeah, I mean the timeline, without pulling up Wikipedia, in 2005 was he done with the Vengeance trilogy, or had Lady Vengeance was that still unreleased off the top of your head?
If you look at the timeline of the Vengeance trilogy, you've got Old Boy in 2003, you've got Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance previous to that in 2002, and Lady Vengeance came out in 2005. So essentially the same year. This is almost a repeated thing with Park Chan-wook. More than almost any director you could name, he can manage to do more than one thing at once. So if when we were looking at Memories and Tale of Two Sisters, I'd have almost guaranteed Memories was finished, done and dusted before A Tale came about. Park Chan-wook is easily able to do a project for a segment in a movie while he's carrying on or working towards doing whatever film he's about to do. So,
and as for my opinion of cut, it's recognizable Park Chan-wook, and it's a home invasion premise mixes silly humor, therefore, because that's recognizable Park, some inventive visuals and violence within elegant surroundings, and we sort of expect the best out of Park Chan-wook, and that means for cut that this isn't essential to watch, in my opinion. It's very watchable, but it's more, well, I've seen him do humor before, I've seen him do revenge before, and while the creativity is appreciated, the visual creativity, the silly tone versus the sinister tone and the thematic strands of revenge, they don't gel here as well as I'm used to. It's okay, but throwaway for Park Chan-wook, if I'm being honest. And it's also the longest short out of Three Extremes, and it feels like it sometimes, to be honest. But we'll get to your opinion, of course, as I rattle off mine. The elegant surroundings are cool because we got blood sucking in elegant surroundings. You know, it opens as a vampire movie, and it has theatrical exaggeration as the actress who has sucked her blood and gotten her lunch, she starts having a stomach ache, and she starts playing the piano, and, oh, my stomach, and she's super theatrical, and we realize after a while, we're on a film set. It's someone's theatrical vision. This is supposed to be exaggerated, so that's a fun point. So it goes from advanced camera moves to handheld. Therefore, there's a loose, fun vibe as the crew departs. There's a middle-aged man in pigtails that approaches Lee Byung-hun about a project or a role. He's hassling the director. And the only thing I didn't understand, Paul, is Lee Byung-hun's character living in a home modeled after his movie set or vice versa? Was that the premise? Or did he go back to the movie set?
From what I took from it, the movie set was modeled on his home. But when he's at home, that's his home. When he's at the movie set, it's supposedly a different place. One of the characters actually says something about the movie set and the home being the same. I can't remember exactly what they say, but I think they say that the movie was the movie set based on your home, and he just sort of acknowledges it. So
some kind of narcissism going on here, because he feels like a loose guy. He's not this stuffy guy necessarily that goes home and now we're going to go to the opera, dear. He's not highfalutin that way, so I guess that's a joke too. But it is home invasion rather than chills and horror here, and it's not tense home invasion either, because Park Chan-wook, and I know he does this, he infuses it with an aura of playfulness, and it's visually creative, considering that the man that Im-Won, he plays, he has glued the fingers of the wife onto the piano, and she's elevated in the air through strings from the top of the ceiling, and she's essentially a marionette puppet, which is a very, very creative image. It feels less horror and less chilling, and more like, oh, that's creative. It's minor fun for a while, since the home invader is obsessed with this going according to script, and he needs things to be timed well. And then that cuts to him performing all of his previous grand roles as extra, including being a frogman, a diver, being a soldier, being a doctor. I think Park Chan-wook is stretching his... it has worked before very well to switch into very silly. I don't think it works very well here, because I wanted more tension out of this, and we're looking at a clown. I'm sure he thought to himself, I'm going to shock the audience by therefore including violence, as he then chops off the fingers of the wife and all of that, and the axe hits obviously the piano, so we got a sort of fake sting, as the fingers are cut off, and that's great. But feeling, I wanted anyway personally some more chills and fright out of the villain. His switch between goofy to dark, I wanted that to be felt more, and I didn't think he was felt enough, because he is too much of a goofball most of the time. It has bizarreness, this short, that doesn't land as well as I wanted to. The breakdown for Lee Byung-hun's character, you know, as his indifference as he confesses to his wife how he really feels about her, that's interesting. Some of it feels more real. It stings to hear all of these words. But then I was engaged for a while, because I thought to myself, maybe he's trying out acting to get out of the situation. You know, when you talk about things like Park Chan-wook uses cardboard cutouts for humorous purposes, that sounds like, boy, that sounds genius, but I think it's going too far, Paul. I really think it's going too far. And at some point, I think maybe Park Chan-wook is actually talking about his own feelings about humor in movies, going for cheap laughs, because at one point I think there's a flatulence humor here. But that doesn't cause us to forgive him for what he's done before. I'm saying us, I don't mean you, but I don't think it erases what I thought of the humor before. But it snaps into sinister eventually. There's a genuine mental breakdown as Lee Byung-hun's character is forced to do something against his will. But that primal nature that concludes the short, I hate to say it, I didn't particularly care at that point, because the different elements of light and dark didn't gel as well as they have before. So cut this, I wouldn't say disappointment, it is good enough, but I wouldn't return to it anytime soon in terms of rewatching Park Chan-wook movies and what have you. So that's my review of it. What do you think about cut?
When I went into Three Extremes for the first time to watch specifically Cut, as it opened, you've got the sort of Park Chan-wook beauty visuals done by Ryu Sung-hee, production lady production designer, who has worked with him for years. And, you know, I'm excited because you recognize her work. She did, you know, loads of his films. She's done Thirst. She did The Handmaiden. She also did Hansel and Gretel. And if anybody's seen it, you just remember her visuals.
She puts her work in and her team to work. Speaking of Hansel and Gretel, there's so much in volume there to place in the scenes, you know.
Totally. So, you know, straight away, I'm excited. And then we get the scene that turns out to be a film scene from a fictional movie about a vampire. And the vampire is played by actress Yoon Jung-ah, who I have written about in the last 6 months repeatedly. She was, in New Korean cinema, the scream queen. She was the stepmother in A Tale of Two Sisters. She was the friend of the girl who might or might not be a murderer in Tell Me Something. She was in, you know, serial killer movie H.
And Mimic, not too long ago as well.
Yeah, much more recently she was in Mimic as well. She's done a lot of other stuff. She's done melodramas like Sad Movie and, you know, social dramas like Cart. But
by the way, can I just stop you? Is that totally an ironic drama, naming it Sad Movie, or
No,
really?
It's the story. It's four stories intertwined of people whose lives essentially fall apart. They have one tragedy after another. And the first couple, they're really touching. By the third or fourth, you just think, this is just one heartbreak too much. This is a sad movie, but not in the way you mean.
Hmm.
Anybody interested, there's a review of it on Hankel Celluloid, but, you know, it's just, it's one sad movie too far. But anyway, you know, even in the midst of her doing cuts, she is the Scream Queen. So she turns up on screen, turns out to be a vampire. I'm salivating. I'm on the floor. I'm ready for the best short I've ever seen. And once it moves to Lee Byung-hun's home, and we see the, you know, his wife tied up at the piano, and the whole revenge, or, you know, discussion revenge thing starts, I felt an utter letdown, because it's too long, it's too slow. Like you say, the comedy really doesn't work. And as we see the kidnapper, I guess you could call him, doing his different little scenes as a diver, as a doctor, as a whatever, all I kept doing was comparing it back to a scene in Old Boy at the very early stages, where Chaemin Sik is in a police station, and he's pissed, he's completely drunk, and he puts on the wings of his little daughter that he was going to take home as a present, and he starts sort of dancing about. And it's a similar sort of feel, but one works perfectly because there's a drunk man just going, and one doesn't work because it's put in for the sake of it. Sadly, Cut is the weakest of the three films, in my opinion, that we're looking at tonight. I don't think it does Park Chan-wook justice. And considering that we've got Lee Byung-hun, one of the biggest actors you could mention in Korean cinema right through the years, it's got Kang Hae-jung as his wife, who most people recognize from Welcome to Dongmukkol.
Is she the main village woman in that movie? Welcome to Dongmukkol.
Yeah, the young woman who, for a lot of it, seems to be just a little bit of a imbecile, really, but sweetly so. Yeah, and she's done oceans of what I would deem to be superlative films, regardless of genre. She did a romantic comedy called Kiss Me, Kill Me, where she tries to get an assassin to murder her. Beautiful film, and she's still going today. You've got Imwon-hee as the kidnapper guy, and again, he's one of these people that you probably won't recognize straight off. You'll recognize his face, but you won't be able to place him. But he's been in things from Die Bad to No Blood, No Tears to Crying Fist with Chaemin Sik to My Dear Girl Jin Young, and last year and this year he's been in that huge hit that shouldn't really have been a hit, Along with the Gods. The cast is just phenomenal, and it does Park Chan-wook credit that he chose them so well, but they're, in my opinion, just a little bit wasted because the film's too long, it's too slow, and it's not gripping enough. It's engaging in parts, but it just didn't hold me, and I was okay with it ending.
Does it go too far with the humor and also the setting being so stylized? Is that something that takes you out of the movie, this being his house is also built as a movie set, you know, because it has, lights in the ceiling and things like that. So is that conceptually a step too far?
Personally, I didn't have a problem with that because, you know, I do, as I say, I love the beauty of Park Chan-wook's films, and such a set or house set allows that. So I let that go. I think he just goes, he's unbalanced with his humor. I think he's taken a story that isn't that inventive, and he's dragging it as long as he can. And I lost it because of the storyline, really, rather than anything visual. I like his visuals.
You know, the switch to primal towards the very end, that needed to mean something more, I think. That needed to be
totally
shocking.
Totally.
And I was out of it by that point because we've been at it for close to 50 minutes, and these shorts have kept themselves at a 30-40 minute range, and that felt more okay. I know it's only 7 minutes, but still, going home is actually closer to an hour, but it's better. So yeah. Just visibly better. So it's not something that you return to as such to sort of remind yourself of how the PogChamp work timeline works. Like you're usually done with cut most of the time.
PogChamp looks a strange director from my point of view. What I like of his, I absolutely adore. And what I don't absolutely adore, I could sort of let go. You know, you already know that I'm not the biggest fan of Old Boy. It's okay. I'm a cyborg. Okay.
That's a clickbait review because the full title of the movie includes okay.
There you go. Fortuitous. You know, but Night Fish and the Handmaiden, you know, JSA, Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. They're stunning. Every single one. I could revisit them endlessly. Cut just doesn't sit in that. And if you look at, while we're on the subject of these directors and their shorts, each of them throughout their career has continued to go back to doing shorts, whether they've been asked by companies to produce segments for this, that and the other, or they've just wanted to do it on their own. If you compare this to Park Chan-wook's Day Trip, which was a 2012 short that was made to celebrate the 40th anniversary of a clothing company called Colon Sport. He did this, and Kim Ji-eun also did a short called One Perfect Day for the same thing. If you compare cut to that, there's no comparison, you know, because he'd just gone in and done a little story about a journey, a day trip, and he just let it go. And it works like an absolute dream, and I could revisit it endlessly, and I would jump over cut to get to it, regardless of Im Jung-ah, Lee Byung-hun, etc., etc.
I got the time to set aside the time to watch to rewatch Box and Dumplings, the other shorts in Free Extremes, and Box was again by Japanese director Takashi Miike. It's super tricky, even though it seems clear, but it works on different levels in terms of, is that a dream, is that reality? But it's actually quite fascinating to watch, even though I can't actually decipher it very well. He's made quite a still tricky movie that, with an end twist, I can't really explain, but I actually quite enjoyed it for that. It's not as extreme as you might associate with Takashi Miike. There's no horrid violence or anything here. It's more about mood. And out of the three shorts, I think the Dumplings is still the best one. It hits, you know, it attacks its theme with both humor, but it's also wildly disgusting. It's not a horror movie, although it has some twists that leans towards, how do you explain that in reality? But it's mesmerizing to watch how they just go for it through sound design, through cinematography, as they shoot these preparations that Bai Ling does with the fetus dumplings. But they're not gleeful about it, because Fru Chan and Christopher Doyle, the cinematographer, who is just brilliant, they don't shoot it in a way where we gotta shoot it for a lower rating. They just figure out creative, unique ways to shoot it, and then manages to disgust us despite. I think it's quite darkly comedic without being, you know, clownish or anything. Hong Kong came out on top again, in my opinion, in terms of the three experiments across the two movies.
I would wholeheartedly agree with you. There is one other thing I would just like to say in terms of the international people that are listening to this. We've looked at three and three extremes, and we looked at them in sort of chronological order, if you like. In terms of internationally, Three Extremes was released first, certainly in the UK.
Same in the US.
And because it was successful, then Three was released as Three Extremes 2. So you've got a second, if you like, a second release that seems to be a sequel, which is actually the movie that came first.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough.
Yeah, totally.
I think it's hard to do it retroactively and just put out Three as Three. I think they might have rearranged the order too, but the order doesn't matter, I think, as such, because these are not connected.
Yeah, totally.
So moving on to the third and final short of this bonus episode. It's not a horror one. It has no frills and chills and what have you. So it's a short called Shaking Tokyo from 2008 from director Bong Joon-ho. And if you're not familiar with the name, this is the director of The Host. So I think that might have been his most... well, it was 2 years before, or rather after The Host. So I don't know. Did he make another movie after The Host? Or did he take his time before he ventured into another movie? Good old Bong Joon-ho.
His film following The Host was in 2009, 3 years later, and it was Mother. And it's one of my favorite Bong Joon-ho films. And I like it a lot more than The Host.
Yeah, The Host was... people raved about it, and it's cool, it's fine, but in all honesty, I think I read that people latched onto it being a very quite valid emotional experience, and I thought they went way overboard with that. I mean, granted, it's Korea, so melodrama is common, but it didn't stick with me, and I'm not a stickler for, well, I only want proper dramatic movies. Hell, I fucking love monster movies, man, but it's one of those, well, it's cool, it's good, but... I like other works of Bong Joon-ho's better. So
yeah, totally. And you know, from my point of view, I went into The Host, you know, being aware of Barking Dogs Don't Bite from, I guess, 2000 maybe, and Memories of Murder, of course, which a lot of people claim is the best Korean film ever made. Here we go with that argument again. I was so blown away by Bong Joon-ho as a director when I went to see The Host. I enjoyed it, but I saw it as a throwaway monster movie, which is exactly what it is. And when Mother came in 2009, I had a huge sigh of relief because he was back to doing, you know, the psychological, the beautiful, the well-written, the memorable. So The Host sort of, to me, was just a little glitch along the way.
And it has to be said that even though he made movies like... Memories of Murder and even Mother to a degree, that wasn't on the outskirts of Korean cinema. These were box office friendly movies.
Yeah.
And The Host was as well. So it was not like, you gotta bring in money somehow. Make The Host. That'll bring in money. He was a name and connected to money. So he had it set, and I think producers and production companies believed in Bong Joon-ho, regardless if he did darker stories or a monster.
Totally,
movie, so.
Totally.
But Shaking Tokyo, and it's the plot goes as follows. A man, played by Taro Yukikagawa, who has resigned himself to a life of solitude, reconsiders after meeting a charming pizza delivery woman. And the background, as for Shaking Tokyo, it was not just released on its own and pushed out into the world. No, from 2008, 2 years after his monster movie that we discussed, Bong Joon-ho was part of the anthology film dubbed Tokyo. It had three segments, all set in Tokyo, two of which were done by French directors Michel Gondry, who is the director of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and another director I'm not familiar with called Leo Carax. And the third movie was by Bong Joon-ho. And it's... by the way, Michel Gondry's piece, Interior Design, opens the movie. Carax follows with The Short Mad. And Bong Joon-ho concludes with this film called Shaking Tokyo. Hence, he shot this film in Japanese with Japanese actors. So it's a departure of sorts, you know, a challenge of sorts to direct across translators and what have you. And I loved Shaking Tokyo. It's as much about letting... the creative involving scenario wash over you as it is about being curious about the outside world that Bong Joon-ho hints at here. You know, what the world has become. We don't get to find out as very much, but it strikes that kind of magical balance of just watch it for the ideas and the creativity, and as a result, the coherent story. And it seems like, you know, a good... puzzle piece to him building his voice. You know, it really is crucial, I think, to him building his voice, even though he was a successful director. So he's not just phoning it in just because he was making 30 minutes of some art crap. But I'm saying that the movie is coherent, though. It's not an art piece. But it is infused with his humor to a degree, as actor Taro Yukikagawa sets the stage of his life through a voiceover. He talks of... what might be perceived as small pleasures or just random observations, like he makes a circle imprint of a toilet roll onto his hand and then sits and muses to himself, well, wonder how long that will last. 10 days? 10 years? You know, he's living a life of solitude, and I'm sure that's a serious definition and real. But it is kind of funny. The character argues he has freedom. He can sleep while he's taking a crap. He can do that with the door open. And you got the image of that, of him sitting on the toilet, obviously, probably mouth open and just looking up in the ceiling. Just sitting there while he's taking a shit. And I love that how Bong Joon-ho shows off that almost seamless camera take going through the apartment, which is either the actor running around to get set in a new area that the voiceover talks about, or we have disguised edits here, because it seems like this shot of showing off the apartment and all the routines is also designed as passage of time, you know. Then it enters, the drama enters, you know, does this life come to a point where you start to long for something in the past, something more in the present, or something more for the future? So there's clearly that, and also psychological hurdles, because he talks about avoiding a room his father used to be in or live in, that he doesn't go into that room. But he is an introvert, and he hates it all. He has anxiety about it all. He even has anxiety about sunlight, although he likes to watch it. He likes to observe it. So what I think Bong is doing really well, he straddles the quirky and serious well, and we understand both. Unlike Cut, the humor doesn't drown out the actual drive of the drama here. I also like that the character has an obsession about time, whether time moves slowly or not, you know, what objects does as time moves forward, whether looking at a clock, whether looking at a pizza carton lid, and how that moves in the sun over time. And these are fun details. These are good details. These are fascinating details. But how does he throw a wrench into this guy's life? You wonder if it's going to be about the father issue, if that's going to be the trigger. You know, you can think about the title, Shaking Tokyo. And obviously, he is forced to deal with an unpredictable event in his life, which is not the earthquake, or seemingly it's an earthquake, yeah. And the direction within all, it leads to the encounter with the pizza delivery woman, obviously. But the direction within this is so sharp. I love the actor's, when he needs to tend to the pizza delivery woman because she has fainted in his apartment. He's jumping around like an animal, deciding what to do with this new species that has dropped into his apartment. You know, at one point he sits in the background, almost on the stairwell or what have you, and he's sitting there crouched, like not knowing what to do. He's absolutely spot on. And she too, the little glimpses we get of her, she's not judgy, but rather she's fascinated about the place she continually delivers pizza to. The characters, Paul, I don't think are too out there either. So you can look at this as some kind of psychological reality. It's not boring either. There's a drive to this, his desire to reach out. Obviously, we get this desire and the need to go outside. And the voiceover is very well conceived, because it's about his inner dialogue, which sometimes is about panic. His attempt at structure is failing, and he doesn't know what to do. And I think my favorite gag, and I'm going to reveal it because I fucking love this gag so much, when he tries to figure out, how am I going to get there? I'm going to take the bus, I'm going to go there, I'm going to go there. Oh, got a bike. And he's stashed his bike, and it's been there for 10 years. So it's there's all kinds of bushes and tree branches grown around it. So he can't get that out of his bike stash. And then that's, you know, I can't do that. So I need to walk. And I think that's a director being on top of his game in terms of, where do I inject humor in a story that the audience are now very curious about? What is this outside world about, of, and what is going on? Because something is going on. I'm not gonna reveal that. And Bong Joon-ho doesn't reveal a lot either. But clearly, time has passed, and there's been changes in society. You can deselect, I think, interpreting this movie and just take it at face value and let the unexplained be that. Or Paul, you can continue the world building in your head, because I think that's the gift that Bong Joon-ho gave us. I don't want 30 more minutes of Shaking Tokyo and having it all explained to me. I think it's intriguing enough and wild enough, but never at the expense of telling the story. You know, it's not crammed with ideas and look at us, we're artists. And then we don't get anything out of it, but we do. So very, very much enjoyed it. A fast moving too. I mean, it's 30 minutes, but still, I just sat through it like that, you know. And even 30 minutes, I can be there, sit there and like, I'm 50 minutes in. Should I take a break? So I really loved it. So thank you for picking it, for heaven's sake. Over to you. What's your opinion of Shaking Tokyo?
I absolutely adore Shaking Tokyo. Out of the three shorts we're talking about tonight, it is by far the most accomplished, the most engaging, and the best made. As all these shorts were, they were both written and directed by the director. So, you know, Bong Joon-ho wrote this. And from the very first moment when you start getting the internal dialogue of the main character and you see his 10 years of toilet rolls piled up ever so neatly, his 10 years of pizza boxes all piled up so neatly, apart from one that's upside down, sort of in the third row, whatever, this, which he missed, but the delivery girl didn't. It's crafted is the only way I could describe it. It drags you in. It drags you in willingly from the very outset. The characters are both engaging. I love the tiniest little things that mean everything. The young girl has got little signs on her body that have different things beside them. One says coma, one says happiness, one says headache. And you find out that pushing one will do something. I think that's it's genius. The story's hugely engaging. The direction is astonishing. It's typical of Bong Joon-ho. I have nothing bad to say about Shaking Tokyo. Nothing bad at all.
Do you think, when you sit and watch it, and again, no spoilers, but obviously the last 10 minutes we get the outside world and we see so many changes, including some that seem that are way out there for we didn't expect that. Does that intrigue you where you wanted more answers or you're content with what you got and then you can mull it over yourself?
It's a very interesting thing from my point of view because I was happy with it as it was and I was happy with it as it was because I'm obsessed with Korean cinema and good Korean cinema will often do exactly that. And it actually brought up an interesting thing in my head, you know, me sitting in front of the TV late at night with a glass of wine thinking things I shouldn't be thinking.
I'm going to get the same tattoos that she does. Wonder if it works.
Yeah, I'll draw it in biro and see. If you look at Park Chan-wook and Bong Joon-ho and even Kim Ji-eun, in terms of what they've done Korean stuff, they've done international stuff. As a site and a film critic, I made the decision in, I think, late 2008 to only review Korean films specifically because I figured that's the way to build a brand, et cetera, et cetera. And at the time I was working and a work colleague pointed out that even though I'd said I was just going to review everything, I was only reviewing Korean stuff and that's where the decision came from. But long story short, Kim Ji-eun's The Last Stand, I won't review it. It's not Korean. But Bong Joon-ho's Snowpiercer, I did review because it felt to me like a Korean film, which just happened to have American actors in it. Even if it was filmed in America, it still feels Korean to me. Okja, which again is a mix of Korean and English, I reviewed it because I considered it a Korean film. When I started watching Shaking Tokyo, I considered it a Japanese movie because it's got Japanese actors, even if it's directed by Bong Joon-ho. At the end, long story nearly finished, at the very end, with that almost in the air thing, that look between characters, I changed my mind and I decided that this was a film played by Japanese actors that was still a Korean film. And I guess at the end of the day, it's made me rethink the statement that sums up your podcast, what's Korean cinema?
Whoa, look at that. A silly joke of mine led to you thinking about stuff, albeit late at night, alcohol infused, but still. But you know what? I can agree with that in terms of, well, you can't take all in, so you gotta set yourself a goal and a focus, which is cool. But I think if you're too manic about that, then you might lose out. It has only got 99% Korean and 1% English. I won't review it. If you're that sort of manic about it, I think you're gonna lose out on fun.
I totally agree.
And Expand is okay. I mean, Stoker did that crossover in terms of, I think I got it right about that. Or was Stoker a no for you?
Stoker, more than possibly anything other than The Last Stand, was a definite no.
Right. Like even before you saw it?
No, because I saw it.
Okay. Ouch.
I've gone to see them all because you think, will I, won't I, before you go in. It was when I actually watched it, and it felt to me like the others. You know, Nicole Kidman's acting is exactly the same in both films. You could almost transpose them. It felt to me like a US film, and was, in my mind, disappointing because of that. So from watching it, it felt American to me. And
you know, but then again, on the flip side, you're still not the kind of character, because you take that stance. You don't go on this sort of rampage and sit on a soapbox online and let people know that this is my stand, listen to me. You just quietly make your decision, share your opinions with the world, but you don't sit there and fume about it and feel pride in your decision that now I can fume or whatever. So, you know, all of that is okay, I think.
I think that's the only way to go. I don't think you have a right to fume. I think you have a right to make your decisions, but you should do so quietly. They're your decisions. You know, people are going to follow your site regardless of what you do. So just give them stuff that you're passionate about and that you feel fit with your remit, and they'll go along with it.
I haven't seen the rest of Tokyo yet, Michel Gondry short or whatever. Did the rest, did it do them in French language, or were they all in Japanese language?
Yeah, with Japanese through. They are all very watchable, but even in terms of the three of those, Shaken Tokyo, for me, stands out by an absolute mile.
Well, it's easy to get because there are US Region 1 options on DVD and Blu-ray for Tokyo, although the Blu-ray goes for nearly $100 currently, so it's not in print, seemingly. But do get it on DVD, because that's very much affordable. There's also a UK DVD by Studio Canal that's readily available for Tokyo, so go out and get it. That's what I'm gonna do. I relied on Paul's DVD for this viewing. Same goes for both of the threes, and as Paul rightly referenced, the first three was released after Three Extremes, so it's therefore Three Extremes 2, both in the US and in the UK. And there are cheap DVD options out there. Totem put it out in the UK, and I think they did separate DVDs and even a two-pack of both of them, and they're all cheaply available still. So I got the Hong Kong imports because I sort of got them on release before they went international. So it's all available to you, and all recommended, because even though not all pieces in the package are good, there are surrounding pieces that are very much good. So you can't go wrong by checking out. So if you're going to start somewhere, I don't know, start with free, because you got the pleasure of watching Going Home, which I think is very special.
So
there you are. But this is the bonus episode. We're going to sign off. Plugging has been done and dealt with in the main episode. So, but I do want to thank you, Paul, for selecting these. It was quite special to watch Shaking Tokyo. I did not know anything of it other than that he had done some kind of short. But that's all I knew.
It was, from my point of view, a lot of fun choosing the three and being as impressed as I was with Shaking Tokyo.
But at any rate, we are done for this bonus episode. This has been the website exclusive bonus episode. Hope you enjoyed. I've been Kennedy, and with me was Hangul Celluloids, Paul Quinn, who's going to enjoy an evening of alcohol and some more musings that might not or might connect to my silly jokes in the past on the podcast. Who knows?
I've got a list of your silly jokes. I'm going through them nightly just to see what I think. So
one landed and one continues to sort of thrive and grow. So take us out, buddy, and say goodbye to the fine people.
Thanks for listening, guys. See you later.